Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus. My Olympian mission is to promote lifelong personal development, human empowerment, out-of-the-box thinking, creative self-expression, and a dedication of one's unique talents to community service. All of my labors in this lifetime celebrate the hero's journey in myth, legend, spirituality, popular culture, and in daily life. I firmly believe that the human spirit is essentially heroic and always seeking ways to express its innate nobility and greatness, and that a life fully lived, dedicated to actualizing the highest we can conceive, is the noblest expression of human existence. Tonight, I'm very proud to bring you our Living Theurgy Forum, and I'm about to introduce you to some of the most amazing people I know. Greetings, Brandy. How are you?
Fumbling the mute button. I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing great. Greetings, Jean-Louis DeBiasi. How are you? Jean-Louis, we seem to be having a connectivity problem. If you can call back in, that would be great. Thank you. And Apollonius, how are you?
Oh, there we go.
Okay, that's much better. How are you, sir?
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much. Happy to be there.
And happy to have you here. And greetings, Apollonius. How are you?
I'm doing very well. And how are you doing, Hercules?
I'm doing very well. Did a lot of shoveling today. But other than that, doing fantastic. This has been a very creative time. So, it's a difficult and a challenging time, but it's very creative. And greetings and welcome, Tony Mirzwicki. How are you?
I'm fine, Hercules. How are you today? It's so wonderful to be back on the show.
Great to have you here. Tony and Brandy suggested we focus on current events, and Brandy had a couple of categories that she wanted to address. So I guess we'll start with Brandy. Brandy, would you like to bring up the categories?
Gosh, I don't remember them. What were the I don't remember current event categories. Hercules, do you remember what I wanted to talk about?
I did a few minutes ago, but let me see over here.
I can read it out.
Okay.
Go, Tony.
I can read it out. So in the original email, there are two categories. The first one's on death, and the second one is racism in the classics. So what Brandy wrote regarding Theogene death was, I'm currently living in the field of a person who is making a slow transition from this life, so I've been thinking a lot about death practice. Theurgy and Tantra agree that death is a theurgic moment when the soul can make the leap beyond the circle of rebirth. I've sat with other people making the transition. I wonder if others among us might have experience with this too. How can we provide support and facilitate?
Brandy, do you still want
Thank
to talk
you,
about
Tony.
That topic?
Sure,
you're welcome,
I would love
Brandy.
To. Yeah.
Okay, so, Brandy has the floor.
Yeah. And that was very well put on my part. And it's actually a really good question. I have a tantric practice that I share with my husband. There's a practice of taking the light body of a deity, which helps you to actually build up your own light body. And as usual, I'm very reminded that that tantra and theurgy are very consonant. That when we talk about putting ourselves in the field of a deity, we talk about that in theurgy as systasis or union with deity. And there are tantric practices that do that are extant, right? And I'm wondering if there is a way that we can, as theurgists, talk about doing that same kind of practice where we help someone to strengthen their ohema, the ego is ohema, the star body, and also to kind of move them into the field of what you might think of as their personal deity or their leader god, right? And I don't know if there's anything in the ancient texts about that. So I was very curious whether anyone on the forum had a knowledge of the ancients talking about that in particular.
Apollonius might be a good place to start on that one. And then Jean-Louis.
Yes,
yeah,
well,
but
you are
invited to start.
Okay, good. Maybe Jean-Louis can do a little better than I can do. I can't offer anything too definitive. I mean, we know that some of the ancient theurgists practiced a practice of dying before you die, and in particular of doing a symbolic, really a death and resurrection. And we have hints of how that worked. It was patterned after a typical ancient Greek funeral. And so, that was the sort of the symbolic context for it. And because it was the practice I'm talking about was done for a person who was not actually dying, but I would imagine you could do something very similar for a person who was near the end. What maybe would not transfer so directly is that the person themselves, the subject, would do a number of breathing exercises and visualizations, which basically would be a process of, in their mind, separating their, roughly speaking, their soul from their body, more specifically the ochema, the vehicle of their soul, and their soul from their body, and ascending up then through the spheres and up into the realm of the gods and up to the ineffable one. And others attending or assisting, including sort of the theurgist that would be managing this whole business, would be they would be singing various sorts of chants and hymns, again, all symbolically constructed to basically carry the or help the person's soul to ascend. In particular for this, and this might also be the case for a person who's doing this at the end of life, there was a notion that the material daimons, these are the daimons that aid material manifestation. And so their work really is to bring immaterial things down into material manifestation and embodiment. And so if you're trying to separate from your body and raise up, their natural tendency is to fight against that. And that would be, of course, most people's natural tendency too, is to not become disembodied. And so some of the practices were, we find this in the Chaldean oracles, for example, some of the practices were essentially giving you some help to go against the material daimons, the hulikoi daimones. And in doing this, you would also recruit other deities, Hecate in particular, to help in this ascent process. And so I would think, now, of course, if this was done as a theurgical practice, as a kind of an initiation and a rebirth ritual, then the person would be brought back down again into his body, and again, the theurgist and his or her assistants would be assisting that whole process, again, with hymns and chants and various sorts of theurgical mechanisms like that. So I would imagine, because this, in fact, was really sort of based on ancient funeral practices anyway, you could basically use a very similar process to help a person's transition in that way. And now how much they would be able to do themselves, of course, would depend a lot on how they were doing at the end. But certainly in terms of the theurgist and the assistants, they could help the person. You know, and again, depending on how the person's mind was, especially towards the end, they could set up, try and do these visualizations and exercises themselves to essentially aid this transition. And what this is really doing also, as I'm sure Brandy knows, is basically purifying the light body or the ethereal body, separating it from the corporeal body in that sense. So that's, I guess maybe I should stop there. And again, we don't have detailed descriptions of this either as a theurgical practice or as a end of life transition, but that's kind of, you know, what's been put together. And it makes sense. It sort of fits with what else we know.
Thank you, Apollonius. That was incredible and awesome. Thank you. Jean-Louis?
Yeah, thank you again for this explanation. So what I want to share with you first is about the order. I am Grand Master, the Orum Solis, and the death experience is mainly the main goal of the full training of the order. We knew theurgy, in fact, to achieve this important moment and to give the opportunity to every initiate to cross this threshold in full awareness. And for that, they need two things. First, to have a specific training on very precise psychic abilities, such as breathing and focus, and the visualization of very specific spiritual entities or deities. But I don't want to go in the direction of deities because this is so complicated, linked to death, that I prefer to not go there. And to achieve that, you need two things in our theurgic process. And based on the Western tradition, you need three things. First, the training I was talking about. Second, a very rare initiation, real initiation. I can tell you that usually it occurs in a cave. And I can tell you also that this kind of initiation is rare because the initiation is not symbolic, really not. The candidate or the one that has been accepted goes through this ritual, this initiation, following, and Apollonius talked about Kalyan oracles and hymns. We can add drums and different sounds, use of vowels, vocal sounds. And the experience is real. That means you go in, you allow the initiate to go out of his body, but not just out of his body, to really die and to come back. And to do that, you need someone who has been trained to go on the other side and is able to help the candidate to come back in the body. If not, he died. He dies. So this is a real experience, and to let you know, for example, in my life of initiate from the 1980s, maybe I did this initiation to someone for 3 or 4 times maximum. So this is the point and the goal of this kind of theurgic Western initiation and mysteries. So this is rare, complicated, and we need a training. So for people who are not at this level to go through this very intense initiation, risky initiation, the training of the psychic abilities themselves are quite enough if the initiate is able to fight the illusion and develop this awareness and focus. And in this case, even without this kind of initiation, it can go through the threshold of death. And to help him, we have few rituals. One is dedicated for people initiated. So the companions are close to him or her and will perform a ritual to maintain and to help him to maintain this awareness, him or her. It could be at distance. The best is to be very close. And so it works. And there is another kind of ritual we can use for people who already died and to help them to become aware of the place they are. So just after death. But I want to emphasize something very important. And for me, this is really, really a key. To achieve that, you need people who can really, and not symbolically, really go on the other side in a few seconds, if this is needed, to help someone, to see where he is or she is, to see if he's okay, lost, if he needs something, so to be able to talk with him or her, and to know what they need. And this is the process, I think, the most important. So, yes, symbols, prayers, hymns, visualizations, and so on are very important. But in the same time, if we cannot achieve the fact to go on the other side in full awareness in few seconds, we are helping, but we guess we help. We cannot see, really. And this is a very, very important part, I guess, to try to understand the mysteries of death, to understand what Apuleius was saying in the past, the Chaldean oracles, and so on. So this is not coming only from books, but from a direct experience. You can experiment, you can control and check every time you do it. So this is a way I see that, I live that, and usually someone doing that, and I do that, a few others also, usually you remember a few parts of your past lives. This is a kind of part of the training, very young, to receive that. And to do this practice. And when we read the text coming from our Western theurgic tradition, I am always amazed to see how they are close to unveil the reality. And this is amazing to see that few words sometimes have a lot of meanings when you do the experience. And this is why, and I want to conclude on that, and this is why I love initiatory traditions and real ones, I mean, because you can experiment in with several people, and you see that most of the time the basics are essential, and we can add many things. Basics are essential: purification, work, and initiation. Sorry to be long.
No, that was very comprehensive, and thank you so very much. Tony?
Jean-Louis, death ritual in a cave is incredibly hardcore. I was particularly amazed by the inclusion of shamanic elements, where you'd have someone with something like shamanic training going into the afterlife to make sure that the person's okay. I never really hear about that sort of thing happening in ceremonial magic. I only hear about it happening in shamanic circles, so it's pretty amazing. My thoughts actually follow on from Apollonius's thoughts. So I was going to talk roughly along the lines that he was mentioning. I was going to point out that with some of the Gnostic schools, they would have rituals that would prepare them for death. So they were taught formulas for appeasing the archons in order to penetrate the planetary spheres as part of an ascension rite. Apollonius was talking about how important it would be to have someone perform an ascension rite. So in the case of a for a theurgist, a rite of ascension such as the Mithras liturgy may well be very appropriate. And when we look at the Chaldean oracles, there are hints that they had ascension rites in that as well. The thing is that each religion has its own process for preparing for death. So with the Tibetan Buddhists, they have the Tibetan Book of the Dead, where that's read out to someone as they're dying. And that enables them to navigate through the various bardo states and work their way to the afterlife. The Orphic initiates would be buried with gold leaves containing instructions. So I think that some sort of ritual for a person who's dying would be very appropriate, but it has to take into account the belief system of the dying person. I think that at the very least, you need some sort of psychopomp figure, such as Hermes, and enlist them. Also, offerings to the destination would also be appropriate. So again, it comes down to your belief. If you believe that rather than ascending, you're going to be descending into the underworld, then you may well consider making offerings to Hades and Persephone, perhaps even appease Charon, you know, the boatman with coins on the eyes. I was just going to mention that a few months ago, I did a joint working with a friend of mine. My mother had just died and his father had just died. My mother was a devout Catholic. She was a late Carmelite nun. So the ritual that I did for her, and meanwhile I had my buddy doing his ritual in Florida, took place on the day of Hermes. So I was calling on him, enlisting his aid, but for her sake, I called on Jesus, Mary, and the Archangel Michael, as I wanted her to get to the afterlife that she wanted for herself, not what I would want for myself. And as I said before, I think it's extremely important to work with the belief system of the person who's dying. You don't want to impose your beliefs on them. You want to make their transition as seamless and as painless as possible.
Wow, thank you so very much, Tony. I'm going to add my thoughts here. I don't think I can suggest anything ancient, but I know from working with people who are not getting out of a bed, for instance. I've worked in like ICUs and other like hospices and places like that. When people are lucid toward the end, good memories are the best thing that they can have. And regrets is the worst thing that they could have. And from the regrets aren't usually like, the regrets are that they could have gone someplace and they didn't, that they could have done something that they didn't, that they could have told somebody something and they didn't. So those are the type of regrets. And the good memories aren't the types of things that we focus on as we try to establish ourselves in our society. Again, they focus on moments with people or, you know, doing something that, you know, they want to do or experiencing something very pleasant. And when people lose the lucidity, they seem to fall into, you know, when they fall into dementia, they seem to fall into like dream states. So they don't know what's real or not real. You can put those in quotes. I don't think anybody really knows what's real or not real. But they seem to experience dreams. And like when you don't have dementia, you know, your dreams kind of reflect your preoccupations. So one of the things that taught me was to not have too many regrets and to create and cultivate as many good memories as I can. And then the third thing is if somebody alive cares about them enough to be there and to listen, you know, to what they have to share. And even if that person is somebody who works in the facility, that becomes a really important thing. Again, when the person is not leaving that bed. So what it taught me was, in addition to doing those things, to do some of the things that are in our culture about like life after death. You know, you're told that your life flashes in front of your eyes and that there's some sort of judgment. That goes back to antiquity. So what I try to do as often as I can is reflect upon my day or my days or deal with whatever memories pop in there. And if it's something that hits upon a regret, I acknowledge that I did that, you know, and take responsibility for my action. And then I try to find ways of having done it differently or better, you know, and again, releasing it once I face it and once I acknowledge that, you know, at this particular point, there's nothing I can do about it. But I see, you know, what that was trying to show me. So for what it's worth, that's what I found in terms of working with people who are toward the end, be they lucid or not so lucid, you know, just be there, help them focus on and appreciate the pleasant and what value they perceived they had, and, you know, just try to get them to release the negative and not be plagued by it.
Hercules, can I add something to that really quickly?
Sure. Yes.
I read an article by a nurse who worked with the terminally ill, and she would speak to a lot of people as they were dying. And what she found after multiple conversations was that nobody was interested in how much money they had, what possessions
right.
they had, how much overtime they'd worked. The only thing that was meaningful to them were their memories, the relationships that they developed
mm-hmm.
with family and friends.
Yep.
That is the only important thing. That's actually a life lesson for us.
Yes.
To not chase after material things, but chase after meaningful relationships with people. You know, man is a social animal after all.
And create as many pleasant memories as you can. Appreciate the people in your life. Appreciate your life. Appreciate each and every moment as
yes,
often as you can. Yes, that's what I find. Thank you, Tony. Brandy, since you brought up this topic, is there anything you'd like to ask anybody or comment about?
That was an amazing collection of knowledge and wisdom. And I was thinking, Hercules, that I would really love to see a transcript of this. I'm going to go back and listen to it again. Everyone had such wonderful and in-depth sorts of things to add. I was struck when Jean-Louis was talking about having the initiatory process and being with the group of people who are helping you through this process, that is a really important part of these traditions. We're lucky enough, Alex and I are lucky enough that we've had these initiations in the tantric tradition, and that's his tradition, right? So that's what I'm working with, and I'm very fortunate that I know how to help him, and he knows what the breathing practices are, what the visualizations are, what the chants are, and what the hymns are. So we have those things in there extant. As Bruce was talking, I was thinking, I could write that ritual. That would be awesome. And Tony, too, talking about the Mithras liturgy, the keys there, there are several keys there, right? That one of the keys is that the daimons will keep you in the material realm. And there's this idea that the sublunary realm, the realm below the moon, is where the soul gets trapped in this series of reincarnations. With the Mithras liturgy, you do it at the dark of the moon, and you skip the moon to attach to the sun. And so that might be an important piece of that ritual. And then the idea that you ascend through the spheres, you can map those onto the Olympians. So that would be something that would be possible to write. The third thing that occurred to me is that there are really two different kinds of candidates for this kind of ritual. One person is an initiate who's doing breathing exercises, knows who their deity is, has a deity practice, and you build it around that person, as Tony was saying. The other kind of person, like Tony's mother, is someone who isn't necessarily that. So I've been in the hospital context helping people make this transition in both situations. So when my coven mate had cancer and he was making his transition, my coven was able to create rituals, to create gates, to, as Jean-Louis says, go some way with them to help them move into the place where they needed to go, to help them when they got stuck, which is really a very important and wonderful thing to be able to do. And then mm-hmm. in the case of Ted's mom, she didn't have that spirituality, but we could do the kinds of things, Hercules, that you were talking about, to make sure that she was focusing on the things that she loved to make sure that she had the experiences that were pleasant experiences that she could focus on. And so that's a wonderful collection of ideas. But writing or helping other people through these processes of being death doulas, of being people who help people die. It's, there are two different kinds of categories of people to do it with. So it almost needs like two different ways of looking at it, or two different rituals. So that's my end thoughts. And I really appreciate everyone's input. That's a wonderful set of ideas.
Thank you for bringing up that topic. It yielded a lot. Would anybody like to add to it before we move on?
Yes, I would like to add something about what Tony said about respecting the belief system of the dying people, a person. I had this experience several times. The last time was with my mother, who was a Catholic. And the same, I tried to remember, I tried to speak with my father, saying, okay, who exactly my mother was worshipping the most? And it was Virgin Mary. So when I went to see her on this side and on the other side, it was, yes, not what I wished for me, as Tony said very well, but what was needed for her. Because when they are on the other side, this is exactly that what surrounds them. And we cannot impose, not just for freedom question, but we cannot, because they have this mental construction. And it became reality on the other side. And we cannot destroy that. They are in this reality. And if we want to communicate and to give something, to give an assistance, a support, we need to use the same, exactly what they built during their lives. So, yeah, what Tony was saying, I guess, is a very, very important, not just wisdom, but key of practice. And I wanted to emphasize this point. Thank you, Tony.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jean-Louis. Thank you.
Actually, I just have one more thing. I'm sorry. Okay. No, sorry. Hercules, go ahead and go to Apollonius, and if you want to come back to me.
No, it's okay. You
Jean-Louis reminded me that of this practice. It's a Western esoteric practice from, I think it was Dolores Ashcroft Nowicki who wrote the a book on the sacred thread, where there's a process. She talked about a process of building a place that you will go when you die, building, because we know that there's the possibility of of getting lost in these realms of image, and you build a very strong image of the place where you will go, like a house or house on the beach, and to continue to bring yourself to that, even going to it like every night, and also to make a symbol on the door, so that if you die, say, in a car accident, and you don't know, you don't have a chance to do a conscious transition, you find yourself standing in front of that door, you go, right, that's where I am. So I do that as a regular practice, and I think that's a really good thing to know about too.
I was going to throw that in after everybody else had gone, so I'll contribute to it in a few minutes. Tony, is there anything you'd like to add or say?
I just wanted to thank Jean-Louis for his validation of what I was saying, because he actually helped me to better understand why I've had such a strong conviction that we should always work in accordance with the belief system of the person who passed over. It's something I've sort of known intuitively, but he's actually explained to me why it is so important.
Awesome. And Apollonius, is there anything you'd like to add?
No, I am just blown away by the fabulous insights of everyone else.
Well, thank you. What I'd like to add to this is what Brandy had brought up. I originally came by it through my study of theosophy. And in theosophy, they believe that if you allow yourself to, if you believe you can go to someplace called Devachan. I might be mispronouncing that. It might be Devakan. But that means the realm of the gods. And there you live the most pleasant life you can imagine. And it's different for everybody. It's kind of like your private Elysium. So I also have the practice of, as often as possible, creating in my mind my private Elysium, and then trying to create that here in this realm, which is supposedly very dense and very difficult. You know, so that becomes part of my daily practice, and it's why what I'm doing in the world is called the Elysium Project. You know, and it's why I post every day to imagine something better about the world. So that's a very powerful practice, and I know it works for me. And thank you, Brandy, for bringing that out. I'm not alone in practicing that. You had a second topic, Brandy. Tony, you
got it here. You want me to read it out? Racism in the classics.
Tony had something too. I didn't want to dominate the whole show, and I wonder if Tony had something he wanted to talk about too.
Okay.
My usual thought is to talk about current events, because I want to show how hip and happening theurgy is, but I'm actually really enjoying this as a departure. So we're going to need the other half hour to talk about the second topic anyway. We're not really going to have any time to talk about current events, I don't think.
Thank you, Tony, for your for your interest. Go ahead.
Okay, so this is what Brandy wanted to talk about. This is from the original email. Racism in the classics. The other topic I've been meditating on is the role of the classics in creating and sustaining white supremacy. The New York Times article on Dan L. Peralta's work came across my newsfeed today. I'm interrogating whether, for the love of the gods, went far enough in contesting racism in theurgic thought. I worry that I created a partial apologetic in the way I framed Platonism. I'd be very interested in the thoughts of this esteemed group. And then she provided a link to the New York Times article, which is actually quite an interesting read, I might add.
Awesome. Brandy, do you want to start that one off?
Yeah, and the thing I worry about in particular, I mean, I wrote Woman Magician, and I was kind of called out at that time that I hadn't really paid enough attention to race. Tony, I think we've talked about this. Tony was on the panel with me when an entire theurgy panel was called out by a black person in the audience for not really understanding the context. That particular context. With Love of the Gods, I was interested in touching the universality of Platonism and the diversity that I think Platonism makes possible. The idea that the body is not as important as the soul. The soul is determinative character, and that this opens up the possibility for women to be Platonists, for people of any color to be Platonists, any race, any ethnicity, any religion. You can move into the Platonic thought, and I really wanted to create this as a permission and inclusivity. But I worry that impulse also did create kind of an apologetic, like, look, Platonism is fine, when it really does get used by people who are interested in building a structure that, you know, European thought is better than any other thought that building white supremacist structures, right? So I wondered if any of us had gone around that again, and if we had some current ideas about how to make sure that our field at theurgy is truly diverse and inclusive.
Tony, you read the New York Times article. I didn't get a chance to read it yet. It's been a very busy day today. So can you summarize and add your thoughts?
Well, I'll give you my thoughts on the article. It's basically about a guy, a man of color, who is a professor who teaches the classics. And he's concerned that classics have been used to justify slavery, race, science, colonialism, Nazism, and other 20th century fascisms. And so he's presenting arguments for basically, I think you'd like to see classics gone. And so what my thoughts are that classics were a product of the time that they were written in, the Bronze Age, which was a brutal time, very different to our own, where women were property and all those outside your tribe were considered potential enemies. I think that attacking classics is easy because they're a soft target, because interest in them is declining. and students are choosing fields with a better chance of finding employment. Education is so expensive in this country, and if you want to have any chance at all of being able to pay off your student debt, then you really need to go into a well-paid field. So studying the classics is not a guarantee for having a lucrative life. The other thing is that as educational standards decline, many Americans have very little understanding of what the classics are and their significance. So if the classics were gotten rid of, the average man in the street would have no idea. It's like, oh, well, you know, I don't know anything about them, so they couldn't have been all that important. But it's important to note that there is another Bronze Age text which has also been used extensively to condone slavery, misogyny, and genocide, and it's the Bible. So imagine if someone tried to either ban or rewrite the Bible. In this country, 3/4 of the population identify as Christian. You may even have rioting on the streets if you tried to ban the Bible. And as an aside, societies change as time goes on. So looking at TV, for instance, much of what was once aired on TV could no longer be aired now. A few decades ago, it was okay to be racist, to denigrate women, and openly smoke cigarettes. Early movies can still be viewed so long as they're seen as flawed. And I don't think that it's the classics themselves which are the problem. It's how they've been applied. And it's the same thing with the Bible. Many fine individuals have used the Bible as the core of their value system, and they've led exemplary lives. So it's not the Bible that's at fault. It's how it's interpreted, it's how it's applied, and it's the same thing with the classics. You can look at the beauty in the classics, the value in them, and live your life very well accordingly. But if you cherry-pick through it, it can be used to justify colonialism and fascism and the like. So just in closing, I think that there's a lot that we can learn from the heathens, you know, the people who worship the Norse gods. Their beliefs and symbols have been appropriated by white supremacists. Are they abandoning them? No. They're trying to rescue them from being debased. And we should be doing the same thing with classics. We have to understand that they are a product of the Bronze Age and hence flawed, but they're still incredible repositories of wisdom. I personally feel that our society would be much poorer if we stopped studying the classics, if they became banned. And just on a related note, a few months ago, there were students who felt that they were triggered by elements of Greek mythology. You know, Zeus can be seen as a serial rapist. So a number of girls in the courses were feeling triggered. So it's a case of, you know, issue warnings, tell people that this could possibly trigger you, and if they need to walk out of the lecture, they do. But it's a case of, you know, if some people are sensitive to them, then they shouldn't be studying them. But for the rest of us, there is much wisdom to be gained from a study of the classics and mythology in general. That's sort of, you know, basically, I was talking more about the classics rather than theurgy. I think Brandy would have preferred it if I'd targeted more theurgy.
I think you did great. And unfortunately, this is a topic that requires a lot more attention. We'll move forward with it. Thank you. Those were all phenomenally excellent points and worthy of much further discussion. Apollonius?
Yeah, this is a really good topic. Although I'm not a professional classicist myself, I have a lot of friends who are professional classicists. And so they've been talking about this for a number of years now. And it's a really a very multidimensional problem. And so I'm going to maybe give you a few perspectives on it that I'm working on. I can't say I've got this all figured out by any means. So as I see it, one of the issues is the valorization of the classics, and that's implicit in the name when we call something a classic, whether it's classical music or classical literature or classical art. And so to my mind, one aspect of that is exactly the same issue we find with, for example, statues of Confederate generals. If you put them in the town square, you're valorizing them. you're saying that this is a, you know, a person worth looking up to. And in some sense, I would say the admirable qualities of that person far outweigh the less admirable qualities. Or you can put the statue in a museum with a lot of supporting material, contrary material, documentation, and so on, and say, well, this is somebody that played an important role in our history, and, you know, why that was. So in the first case, I think we're valorizing the person, and in the second case, it's a piece of data about our past that we can talk about and think about. And so I think it's very much the same with the literature of Greece and Rome. If we say that in some sense this was the high point of Western civilization and that we should be emulating that, and the art and literature and ideas of ancient Greece and Rome are better than those of any other culture, well, that's a kind of valorization. And that's, I mean, it's obviously a silly idea, but I think that's the idea, especially that in the past, Eurocentric scholars and people with various sorts of racist and nationalist sorts of agendas are going back to. But that's different from what bona fide classics scholars do, which is study this literature critically, understand it, get what's good from it, realize what's bad about it, and think about it, you know, and use that as a way of growing. You know, and the other point, of course, is the ancient Greeks, they, you know, were often bragging about what they got from what they considered the older civilizations, from Egypt,
yes,
from the Middle East, and from Persia, of course, and other civilizations, and even, you know, India. As far east as India. So that said, though, so the word classics is kind of bad because it has that valorization built in. If we just called it ancient Greek and Roman civilization, then it would be on a par with ancient Chinese civilization and ancient Indian civilization and ancient African civilization and so forth. The other aspect, though, is we do have to recognize, I think, that for, I'll call it Western culture, which I think is a well-defined concept, in spite of the fact that it's really largely spread around the world, if we do talk about Western culture, we do have to acknowledge the historically significant part that ancient Greek and Roman culture had in it, for better or for worse. I mean, arguably, we've got some of our bad ideas also from the ancient world. And so in that sense, at least insofar as we consider ourselves Westerners, or that our own personal worldview is largely Western, ancient Greek and Roman civilization is a much more important part of that than perhaps other civilizations, which were, you know, arguably just as worthwhile, but perhaps did not have such a strong effect on us as individuals, and especially on us to the extent we consider ourselves Westerners. So, you know, I think that that's a delicate balancing act, too. It's like, okay, you know, we can study many different things, you know, but in terms of understanding our own culture, how we got where we are in the 21st century, in the United States in particular, where the founding fathers we know were very much influenced by ancient Greek and Roman culture, and again, for better and worse, if we want to understand our own society and our own culture, how we got here, our history, then we kind of have to privilege not valorization, but privilege in terms of the attention or the time we devote to it, ancient Greek and Roman civilization. If we were studying modern China, then, of course, we would not be paying so much attention to it. We'd be paying attention to the whole historical background of China. So anyway, that's not, you know, those kind of scattered thoughts, but it is a really complicated thing to try and, on one hand, respect our history. On the other hand, And I'll give you another problem, too. I call this the Scylla and Charybdis, again, for Westerners, and especially for Western pagans. You can say, okay, well, you know, we're Westerners, so the paganism that's most influential on us is ancient Greek and Roman paganism. If, you know, we start grabbing ideas from the East or from Native American traditions or from African traditions, well, that then tends to slide into cultural appropriationism. You know, so kind of as Westerners, again, if we think of ourselves that way, as Westerners, if we're not going to be appropriating other cultures, then we have to kind of stick with our own culture, which is, you know, I would say the, you know, the tradition we call that stems out of the Greek and Roman worlds, which, of course, again, built on others around them, but, you know, we normally think of it as Greek and Roman. So I don't know. Those are a bunch of scattered ideas. It's a hard problem, and I can't say I've really got a good grasp on it by any means. But it's certainly worth thinking about. It is without doubt that the classics have been badly misused by scholars and by politicians for hundreds of years, and we do have to try and fix that.
Thank you very much. That wasn't just scattered. That was very well organized, and you brought up a lot of issues. Again, we need to devote at least a couple of shows to this. Jean-Louis?
Thank you for everything, but few words, very short. I am always reacting when we are talking about the Bible. I have several volumes. I learned Hebrew to read the Bible in the text. I did that in the 80s, 90s, and I spent a lot of time doing that. And in the same time, training myself in theology. And my conclusion at the end is this is a waste of time. Waste of time. Why? Because what is claimed inside are usually misogynist, violent things, mainly good things, but so few regarding the number of pages. And when we have a Corpus Hermeticum that is presenting just philosophy, initiation, why wasting our time on a book trying to interpret something as we do not know when we will die? So I think that a good advice could be to go immediately to something that is luminous, not just luminous 10%, but 100%. Learn a lot from that and be ready to go on the other side at any moment. So this is interesting on a cultural level to know about the Western tradition and to know about the Bible, the Kabbalah, and so on. But on the practical level for theologists and for if we have just few seconds to live, few minutes, few days, go to the Corpus Hermeticum, go to our historical text, and it will be really good. And if we want to find really morals, better to go to theology and Hermeticism, because and ancient classics, because philosophers are very clear. Neoplatonicians are very clear. They are not trying to find symbols and so on. You have immediately what is good for us and for the world and for the city. So why to waste our time? So I want to go straight forward on something clear for the practice and for society.
Awesome. And I wish I had time to comment. You guys brought up so much wonderful material. Brandy, was that helpful to you?
It was, and I think it's a great idea to come back to this topic.
Awesome. We have like a minute each, so if you could please share your contact information. We'll start with Brandy.
You can find me at brandywilliamsauthor.com. My book, Chord Magic, will be released by Llewellyn in April, and I'm looking for someone to help me do the marketing, so if anybody knows anyone, send them to me.
Thank you. Tony?
Facebook page, either personal or author page, and I also have a column on Pathos called Holistic Spirituality.
Thank you very much. Jean-Louis?
You can find me on Facebook, Jean-Louis Debiazzi. You will see that the link, I guess, in the comments. And my website, debiasi.org. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Apollonius?
Yeah, the best way to reach me is through either my two websites, opsopaus.com, that's opsopaus.com, or wisdomofhypatia.com, that's all one word, and Hypatia is Hypatia. And that's the best ways. Thank you.
Thank you. This was incredibly awesome, and I really wish we had more time. You are awesome individuals doing awesome things in the world, and I'm very honored to be among you. I look forward to our conversations between shows and, of course, to next show.
Thanks, Hercules.
Thank you.
Okay, well, and thanks to everybody who joined us from home. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. And we'll be closing off with Virginia Ackley's Golden Bow.
Sang to her the earthly chord.